Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And unfortunately, I just got a note from Alejandro maybe 20 minutes ago. He says, dude, I have nothing to say. And so I said, he was on a cruise last week. He says he has absolutely no idea if a UFO even landed on the White House lawn. Nothing. He has no idea. So he said, I don't really have anything to talk about. And so I said, well, why don't you skip it? I said, I think I'm going to be able to get this guy that I have on the show. I think I'm going to be able to get him to talk a little bit. And so our guest is Derek Gilbert, and he's written a very interesting book. It's actually a really good read and a lot of really good points. I may have some objections to some of the points, but that's what should make it a decent interview. I also want to say April, we have a lot of great guests coming up. Next week, it's going to be Greg Bishop, a great guy. But on April 4th, we have Robert Schroeder. Now, he was on a long, long time ago. And he, this weekend, on March 17th, Saturday, at 2 o'clock, he's going to be at the Morse Library in Natick, Massachusetts, if anyone lives in that area. He's great. And you will see that on April 4th when he's here on the show. So that is, that's at the Morse Library in Natick, Massachusetts, this Saturday at 2 o'clock. So without further ado, I would like to bring our guest on. And I have a whole bunch of questions for him. We're going to be talking about his book, which is The Day the Earth Stands Still. A little play on words there. Unmasking the Old Gods Behind ETs, UFOs, and the Official Disclosure Movement. Welcome to the show.
It's my honor. Thanks for having me on.
Yes. We've had I'm in a hotel room. At first, I have to explain this. We're having a little bit of internet issues, but not as bad as Josh. Go ahead and tell what happened to your what's going to be a co-guest this evening.
Right. Well, Josh and I are co-workers at Skywatch TV, which is a Christian television production company. We produce a number of programs there. The flagship program is syndicated. The rest are sent out through YouTube, Vimeo, Roku, Apple TV, and so forth. But we noticed this afternoon as we were getting ready to upload the last of the programs we needed to send out to our networks today that our internet died. And we've had some issues. We're located in a small town in the Missouri Ozarks. You know, our town in which we're based is about 1,400 people. The county in which we live has, well, I don't know, 20,000, 5,000 people, maybe. County seats 440 people. So we don't expect great internet, but we do pay a premium to try to get decent enough internet that we can send full HD video files back and forth. Nothing happened after about 2 o'clock this afternoon, but it turns out we're not alone. The entire state of Missouri, practically, Mediacom, had somebody slice through two separate fiber optic cables were cut today in different parts of the state. The main cable up in the northwest part of the state, and this is according to local news here, the other in the central part of the state near the town of Cuba, which was the backup line. So all Mediacom cable and internet and phone customers in Missouri from St. Louis to Kansas City are waiting for them to get the one or both of those lines stitched back together. And of course, Josh is one of those customers. So.
Wow. So was it the Russians?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, probably.
I think so. Yeah. There is a lot going on. Well, at least it's not, you know, some nerve agent.
Yeah.
So the book, as I said, it was an interesting read. And so we got a long time to kill here. But I want to ask you, first of all, what was the source of you coming up with this book? What started your path on it?
Well, Josh and I both are, you know, geeks from way back. I was a big, and still am, big science fiction fan. Loved hard science fiction growing up. Read everything I could get my hands on by Larry Niven, especially Jerry Purnell, who just recently passed away, sadly. Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein. So authors like that were my bread and butter through high school. Josh, similar path, you know, always fascinated with the idea that there might be life out there in outer space. Now, fast forward a few years, we find ourselves here in this place, both of us, coming at this from an unashamedly and openly Christian point of view, but I think with a different perspective than a lot of Christians have on the UFO phenomenon. A lot of the the books that have been written about UFOs by Christians tend to just dismiss the whole thing as either non-existent or as the return of the Nephilim. It's all demonic, in other words. And we kind of fall somewhere in the middle. We don't deny that something is going on, but we think the evidence suggests that it's something different than what most people think it is. We also wanted to address a question that I think a lot of Christians make Christians nervous about the phenomenon. If a UFO were to land on the White House lawn, an actual extraterrestrial spacecraft, a lot of Christians, I think, would find their faith really shaken. And we address that in the book because we believe that a proper understanding of Christian theology means we don't need to worry about Zeta Reticulans landing on the White House lawn somehow debunking the Bible.
Okay. I was thinking about asking you some questions along the line of, I understand that there is a really good point to be made about that it's sort of like a religion. You know, UFOs can be, and I have actually seen, and I do agree with a number of things in your book, especially in every time I drop this name, I get some hate mail. But, you know, I agree with what you said about Stephen Greer. And, a lot of people think the world of him. But mm-hmm. anyone that's going to charge someone $50 to take a picture of him inside of a invisible UFO, I don't buy the stuff that he does. He did in the very beginning, he did something absolutely wonderful. And then I just think of, like in your book, you said he gave up $500,000 a year job, you know, to do this. There's not a lot of people, though, and I will tell you this, and you may not even understand this because most people don't, but there's very, very few people in the UFO field, ufologists, whatever you want to call them, that really make any money. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, Travis Walton, you know, I had a conversation with him once. Yeah. He says a lot of times, you know, he's retired now. A lot of times he'll just pay his own expenses to a place. And, you know, they'll get him the hotel room and that's it.
Well, the interesting thing about that is it seemed to us as we went down to the Roswell Festival last year, the 70th anniversary of the famous Roswell crash.
Yeah.
And we saw, you know, Linda Moulton Howe and Stanton Friedman and, Nick Redfern, Greg Bishop got a chance to meet him, would like to interview him. Didn't have the opportunity while I was there. We were busy working on the project that accompanied the book. But Jack Brewer, too, by the way, whose work I cite in the book, really, really found his book, The Grays Have Been Framed, to be very, very helpful. But it seemed to me that a lot of the speakers who go to UFO conferences are very much like, guys like me who go around and speak at, Bible prophecy conferences and theology conferences. You do it because you love it. And because you think you've got something that you hope is important to say. And that was the sense I got from those guys. I didn't see any of those guys getting rich. Even the so-called stars in the field, like Stanton Friedman and Linda Moulton Howe, they were flying the same flights we were. So, you know, they did not look like they're getting high off the hog by pursuing this career. So, and I certainly don't want to cast any aspersions on the character of Stephen Greer. Coming back to the question of the UFO phenomenon as an alternate religion. That was really what triggered the idea for the book when we were looking at research that came out last year and comparing it with research that came out last year on what American Christians believe, and then compared that with some surveys that have been done in recent years by National Geographic Channel on what people believe about the existence of extraterrestrial life. And we found that in America, and this is according to the 2012 survey by National Geographic Channel when they were launching their UFO program, that 36% of American adults believe that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. About 70% believe that there is evidence that we might be being visited, but 36% are convinced that we're being visited by extraterrestrials. But now the Barna Group, which is a survey group that specializes in taking the theological temperature, if you will, of American Christians, found that in America today, only 10% of American adults have a biblical worldview. Now, about 70% of American adults, or three quarters roughly, identify as Christians, but most of them are cultural Christians. When Barna starts asking questions, well, do you agree or disagree with this statement? And then put forth a number of tenets of the Christian faith. For example, did Jesus live a sinless life? Was he born of a virgin? Is Satan a literal entity and not just a concept or force? Things that, according to the Bible, are Christianity 101. And they defined anyone who accepted six core beliefs as having a biblical worldview. So out of the 75% of Americans who say they're Christian, only 10% have a biblical worldview, 10% of all American adults. But of those who claim to be evangelical or born-again Christians, only 17% have a biblical worldview. So we concluded from this that there are more people who believe we're being visited by extraterrestrials than who believe in God as he's defined himself in the Bible. And so when Christians ask us, and this is something we get some pushback within the Christian community, who say, well, you're really wasting your time. This is a fringe topic, UFOs, extraterrestrials. You should be preaching the gospel. Well, okay, we agree as Christians, our mission, according to Jesus, our prime directive, if you will, is to make disciples of all nations. But the fact is, there are more people out there who believe in ET than believe in the words of this book, this Bible here that you carry around. So, you know, yeah. And I think when you start down the path of what the evidence shows, that there's a lot of overlap, at least in terms of the language, between UFO researchers and biblical theology.
Well, you know, I also will say to you, first of all, what makes you believe in the Bible? You know, I mean,
that's a good question.
Here's another, you know, another thing. I do remember back in somewhere in the 1990s, I happened to be in a dentist office and I saw a Newsweek, and on the Newsweek it said something along the lines is that our brains are wired to create a God. So if you don't have a God, you better create one. And I think, you know, you look back, you know, we say we have a monotheistic society when it comes to Christians. But, you know, there, how many of those have there been, you know, with a single deity worshipped? Who knows, over the, you know, since the beginning of time. So there's a lot of similarities, but also as far as the beliefs go, I think this is kind of an interesting topic to compare the two. You know, why does someone believe in God? Why does someone believe in aliens? Now, I will tell you this, you know, maybe there have been things, and we can talk about Fatima, because that's an interesting, I don't know if you know anything about Fatima.
But, a little bit. Our friend L.A. Marzulli has done a lot of research on Fatima.
Yeah. Yep. But then you also, here's the thing. I know what I saw. I saw something over me. I had a UFO experience.
Right.
And it wasn't something that was made up in my mind, or it was a real experience. And there are so many people that have had these real experiences. Now, I'm not saying it's...
Oh, so was Josh, yeah. Josh, so is my wife. Yeah. Yeah. So again, I want to be very clear that we do not deny not only the UFO phenomenon, but we are not we don't deny that there are people who are being severely traumatized by something that has been labeled the alien abduction phenomenon. It's a real phenomenon. OK, both the UFO phenomenon and alien abduction. I'll put alien in air quotes because I reserve judgment as to what those entities truly are. But I've got ideas based on the evidence. But the point is, we do not, absolutely do not deny that something is going on.
I guess I didn't get that far enough into your book to read that part of it.
No.
But, you know, I do also understand that, you know, we have a belief system. You know, when someone, there's a friend of mine, Sam Maranto, and he gets really his feathers get ruffled when someone says, do you believe in UFOs? He says, it's not a belief. It's either they're, you know, either they're here or they're not.
Right.
So I do understand. And when someone asks me if I believe in UFOs, because of Sam, I always kind of hesitate. And it's, what do I, you know, is it a belief system? But so let's talk about some of the research you did, and do you think there it's like a cult, or where are you going with this?
No, not at all. I think what's happening is, and this is really more an indictment of the church, the Christian church. I don't think the Christian church has done a very good job in teaching the reasons why we should believe that the Bible is true. I had to do that on my own. I was brought to church every week when I was a kid, went through Sunday school with all the flannel board, little cute pictures of Noah and his animals going into the ark and all that stuff. But as soon as I got into college, I quit going. And Josh, very much the same way. Josh was, he'll tell you, he was, you know, full-blown New Ager. He was practicing astral projection and doing a lot of other things that we'll make for a really good story. Yeah, you're missing out on some of the really good stuff because he's been silenced by Russia tonight. Putin. So we have different paths through which we came. I kind of went back to my, my sci-fi upbringing, believing that our Star Trek's future was Star Trek, you know, that we would overcome the superstition of religion, and that science and technology would solve all of our problems in the future. Josh was just, he was just fascinated with the concept of life in outer space. I love me a good space opera, again, especially told from a hard science fiction perspective. But when we start looking at the evidence now as adults, and at some point during this conversation, yeah, I'd be happy to talk about Christian apologetics, because that's kind of what led me to all of this. You know, the reasons that I can say that I'm convinced that Jesus of Nazareth actually lived, died, and literally rose from the dead. But again, just being open and honest, that's where I'm coming from my starting point. In looking at the UFO phenomenon, and I will grant, Martin, that you and probably every person who is a real student of the UFO phenomenon is at least as well informed on the research, if not better, than I am. I've had a passing interest in it, kind of kept my eyes on it. But when it came down to research for the book, I had to dig in and really start looking at Maury Island and Kenneth Arnold, the influence of the intelligence community and Joint Security Command, you know, the presence of government agents in every major UFO flap in the late 40s. And there are researchers like Nick Redfern, to whom I will gladly defer, who's done a lot more research and heavy lifting on this. Again, not saying that those things didn't happen, just saying that as somebody who had to look at the Bible with a critical eye and say, okay, let's weigh the evidence from the eyewitness testimony to the archaeology to the ancient texts to the history of the nations around ancient Israel, which is kind of an area I'm specializing in right now. Let's apply that same sort of critical thinking to the modern UFO phenomena. Are there other explanations that may fit the evidence better than the extraterrestrial hypothesis? Again, something is going on. Some of those strange things in the sky may well be government projects that that we just don't know about yet. I would suggest that that's a plausible explanation for the videos that have been released through the to the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences here in December, and then again just this past week, the objects caught on the infrared radar cameras of the F-18 pilots. There are some things that are misidentified commercial aircraft or natural phenomena, the planet Venus, to use an old, you know, cliche. But there are some that are legitimately not explainable by natural phenomena or misidentified or secret aircraft. Those we're really interested in because there are some that appear to defy the laws of physics. But there are researchers such as Jacques Vallée, who is not approaching this with a Christian worldview, and others such as John Keel, who concluded that the extra-dimensional hypothesis or interdimensional hypothesis is a better fit for the evidence, especially when you look at the difficulty, the technological scientific challenges in trying to cross the vast distances between star systems, that it actually seems to make more sense that whatever these things are that are visiting Earth, they're coming from outside our three perceivable dimensions rather than from outside the solar system. And that's kind of the approach we take on the UFO phenomenon. We also touch on the abduction phenomenon. And again, you are looking at a phenomenon that researchers such as Dr. John Mack, the late psychologist from Harvard University, suggested bore so many similarities to the accounts of people who had been subjected to satanic ritual abuse that it was not statistically likely that these things were not somehow interconnected. So again, we start looking at the evidence in that way. We're seeing that if we're drawing a Venn diagram of, say, you know, spiritual encounters and extraterrestrial encounters, there's a great deal of overlap there. And so I think we as Christians and the UFO community can have a conversation here and just kind of compare notes.
I'm going back to the video you just mentioned that just came out a few days ago. It was released through To the Stars. I wonder if I can read that. I actually got a note from a military pilot on that particular video, which is kind of surprising. He says, or he was saying, that this was not a classified video to begin with, and that it was shown at a briefing that he was at, many years ago. I don't know, maybe 10 or something years ago. So he said it was a great example of a slide and catch or something like that. I can't really pull it up right now of what he said. But he said the reason he was shown at the briefing was more about capturing it on the camera than it was about, you know, what the object was. Mm-hmm. But they thought, you know, one time they thought it was some type of missile, but then they just don't know what it is. But it's a very clear, I'm sure you looked at it, it's a very clear image of some type of object, and it's moving very fast, about the same speed as the F-18 itself. But right. Anyway,
I wrote an article about the previous release, the article that was released, or the video that was released along with the New York Times article back in mid-December, which and we couldn't have asked for better marketing, because that video came out like a week after our book came out. So perfect timing. But the story about that, what's being called the USS Nimitz UFO incident from back in 2004. Mm-hmm. Again, that's a classic example of something that you cannot deny. I mean, there's something that was seen, and you're talking about military pilots, guys who don't stand to gain anything by making stuff up. Right. One Marine Corps pilot, a number of Navy pilots, plus the radar operators on the USS Lexington, I believe it was. A number of trained observers spotted this thing. The thing I thought was really bizarre was that the first pilot on the scene saw this, whatever it was, hovering over the ocean, and found that there was an area about 100 meters across that water was apparently breaking over the top of it, like something really big was just submerged. In fact, the first pilot on the scene, Commander Fravor, I believe Fravor was his name.
Yes.
Thought that he had arrived at the site of the crash of a commercial jetliner. So, you know, something was under the, and you don't hear much talk about that. I'm really curious at what exactly was under the water that this thing was hovering over. But anyway, as he began to descend and began to pursue the thing, it took off at a speed that his F-18 couldn't match. And then the radar guys back at the USS Lexington, not Lexington, Princeton, said that it's at the rally point. Well, the rally point was far enough away that when you do the math at how quickly it got there, the thing was traveling in excess of 3,600 miles an hour, which is like twice the speed of the F-18, half again as fast as the SR-71 Blackbird, which is the fastest that we know of, fastest man-made aircraft on the planet. But the thing is, and I was really curious that the second flight of F-18s that came out there, they're the ones who caught it on their infrared radar. It wasn't outgassing anything hot, so it was not burning a fuel for propulsion of any sort. So what was it? We don't know, but that doesn't necessarily mean, which is the idea that's been put forward by Mr. Elizondo from To the Stars Academy, and now I see Christopher Mellon out there who's talking about the most recent video, it doesn't necessarily mean that these objects came from outside the solar system. It may well be that it was a government project, whether United States government, Russian, Chinese, something that moves at in excess of 3,600 miles per hour. Maybe it's something we don't want China and Russia to know about yet.
But well, I do have an argument.
In the case of the second. Okay, go ahead.
Well, my argument is very simple. Is this is not the first time that they've seen something race away at a speed, and there has been speeds clocked up to 20,000 miles an hour.
Right.
That when we're talking, 30, 40 years ago. So another thing is, and
right. In fact, Kenneth Arnold's the sighting that Kenneth Arnold had back in 1947 was at some ludicrous speed. So
yeah,
point is that there's a tendency though on the part of some observers to look at something like this and say we don't know what it is, therefore aliens. And that's not necessarily the case.
You're talking about Giorgio, aren't you? the other thing I will tell you is there's never been a report that I'm familiar with at this point where there's been the sound barrier broken, no matter what speed the thing took off in. It's another real mystery. It doesn't make any sense. There's and a lot of times, the thing that I saw had absolutely no sound, and that was almost the most terrifying, if there was anything terrifying at all. That was more that bothered me or sat in my mind more than anything else. So when these things are moving without making any noise, it really is bizarre. Now, again, you mentioned the possibility of another dimension or something like that. And I never rule that out along with I never rule out aliens either. But I do want to say that, perhaps there's just something in physics that they've figured out how to travel time that, doesn't involve anything that we know of today. For instance,
and that's entirely possible. That's entirely possible.
Right. And, I do want to mention poor Stephen Hawking passed away. I just wanted to mention that. He will be missed very deeply in the scientific community. He did not have too many nice things to say about people that saw UFOs.
But or Christians.
Other than that, he was a good man, and I think he did a lot of really spectacular things. So a lot of controversial and interesting thoughts that man had.
Yeah.
So,
well, again, the existence of extraterrestrials is not something we rule out. Now, for the record, we don't believe that that there is concrete evidence that Earth has been visited by an extraterrestrial intelligence. But like I said, one of the things we wanted to address in the book is that if that proves to be incorrect and, Klaatu stands out on the White House lawn with Gort, hopefully we can all get along. And it comes down to this, because it comes down to the definition of what it means to be created in God's image. It's a problem with translating Hebrew into English. English is not as nuanced a language as Hebrew. When it says, God said, let us create man in our image, it doesn't mean mankind looks like God, that God is a biped that stands between 5.5 and 6 feet tall or whatever. What it means in the Hebrew, the sense we get, is that we are God's image bearers. We are his moral agents on earth. That's the role that humans have been created to fill. And that applies to all of us, regardless of how old we are, how well-developed we are, our lack or gift of cognitive abilities, any disabilities or special abilities that we might have. It applies to us merely because we are human. All of us are created as God's image bearers. Now, some of us, figure that out better than others, but it doesn't change depending on, again, how well-educated we are, how rich we are, whatever. All of us on Earth are created in God's image in that respect. And the landing on the White House lawn, the sudden appearance of an actual extraterrestrial in front of the United Nations would not change that status. So as a Christian, if an actual ET were to land on the White House lawn, I would not throw out my Bible and say, okay, well, I guess this was just a bunch of lies. No, say, hey, cool. God's creation is even more amazing and convoluted than I thought it was.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to ask you is, you know, how does the Christian faith line up with the possibility of being visited? You kind of answered that. But another thing is, you know, I think it's if you went back in time, say, 100 years or 200 years or something like that, I don't think there would be any openness at all to something about. I don't think they would be comprehensible. And there, I don't think, well, actually, I don't think a lot of things. Go ahead.
That's actually one of the things we went into in the book, because in contrary to what most people think, the possibility of life in outer space, the life on other planets, is actually something that Christian theologians have done a lot of thinking about over the centuries. It's only been the last 100 years or so that Christians have kind of shut down that idea, in part because I think a lot of Roman Catholic theologians over the centuries have said, well, you know, we can't rule out that God might have created other worlds. I mean, because to say that he didn't do it or couldn't do it is putting a limit on God, and that's not allowable. So no, actually, in history, you find that, Christians going back centuries, hundreds and hundreds of years, were actually considering the possibility of other planets and other occupied planets.
Now, when you just said a minute ago that, you know, man was created in God's image, or however that is termed, is this your own interpretation of you saying this to make it fit, or where are you getting that information from?
A Hebrew scholar by the name of Dr. Michael Heiser. He's the scholar in residence for Logos Bible Software, and he's also a respected ufologist. He has looked at that, and that is not a let's say that's not a fringe interpretation of that verse in Genesis. Again, when you dig into the Hebrew and understand what that means, it is it's a little more nuanced than created in God's image. It's, again, this is why I say that we, the Christian church, have not done really an adequate job of educating people who call themselves Christians as to what the Bible says and why we should believe it's true.
So what do you think, in your mind, like the extraterrestrial intelligences, as you call them, out there, we're not having a very good track record as far as the way we treat each other, way we kill each other, the way there's wars and all that. Now, so far as we know, whatever it is that's visiting us hasn't really interfered. Or, you know, there's a couple of cases where there was possibility that there was some type of, you know, a shoot down or something of an aircraft or whatever. One in Australia, and there's one somewhere in the mid-states. But as far as we know, we may be, you know, it may not be other creations that are violent like we are. I mean, do you ever think about that? I mean, we don't have a very good track record.
No, that's true. We don't. And in fact, that's entirely consistent. I'll just point out that's entirely consistent with a Christian worldview that says, you know, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. The heart is, you know, inherently wicked. But I think Stephen Hawking might have been onto something here where he said, you know, just looking at the history of the world, when a more advanced civilization comes across a less advanced civilization, it usually doesn't work out well for the less advanced civilization. So he was not really looking forward to the possibility of encountering a more advanced civilization from outside the solar system.
I argue with that because that's human nature. We don't know the nature of what another intelligence is. And it all boils down to how it evolved, you know, really how it survived, whatever, to, you know, evolve into what it has evolved into. The natural instincts to become tribal or hunt and whatever, you know, have turned now into, you know, violence against each other. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And who knows if they even think in those terms.
No, we don't, because they may be so alien and so utterly foreign to us that we can't even imagine what their thought processes are. I mean, they may take more notice of us than we take of the ants on the sidewalk. On the other hand, they might be entirely benevolent. Don't know. Personally speaking, I don't think there is other life out there, at least not that is contacting us directly. I think, and again, this is not a theological hill that I'm going to die on, which is why we address the issue of what it means to be created in God's image, because we think that's an important point, one that is a stumbling block to Christians when they start looking into the UFO phenomenon. What happens if there is other? Does that mean that they're created in God's image too, and would Jesus have to die for them as well? No. But it is a I don't think that something that big would have been left out of God's word. In other words, if there was a possibility that Zeta Reticulans were going to land and begin communications with us, that's probably something God would have told us. But again, that's speculation on my part. I don't have enough information, biblical or otherwise, to make that a theological hill on which I'm going to, you know, defend to the death. A friend of ours has a belief that he calls the doctrine of stated intent, in which he points to the fact that in the Bible, God said he created the stars in the sky to mark the times and the seasons. And so that's their stated intent. He did not say that I put these stars in the sky to host inhabited planets with civilizations that might someday visit you. Okay, I can see where he's getting at. He's supporting it with the evidence. But again, one way or the other, whether we are alone in the universe or whether someday an advanced civilization makes contact with us, that does not change our status as God's image bearers on planet Earth. And so one way or the other, I'm secure in my Christian faith.
Well, all right. Someone just asked in the chat room, they said, I'm confused. Does he believe in ETs or not? So I'm thinking that you...
Okay, let me give you a one-word answer. No.
Okay. You don't. And don't you think that's a little bit, and I'm not saying that you are arrogant, but don't you think that's a little bit arrogant?
Well, no. I mean, we have to reach a conclusion one way or the other. I mean, I could say I don't know for sure, but I don't believe that there are. Now, like I said, I'm not... If I'm proven wrong, it's not going to crush my worldview.
Okay.
I've been wrong about lots of things in my life.
All right. Now,
I've been
a
Chicago Cubs fan since I was 6 years old. I only got right the one time back in 2016. So
let me ask you something. Do you your views of God, I guess. Do you think, first of all, God always was?
Yes.
And so there was never a beginning. He just always was. Now, now I'm going to say something. It might sound a little silly, but okay. If that's the case, then why did he wait for till only 14 billion years ago to start the universe? He always was. What was he doing all that time?
Well, that's when I'm going to take the I don't know. If I could know the mind of God, if I could understand the mind of God, God would be this small, where he could fit inside this head here, and he'd be a pretty small God.
You know, that's a cop out. I guess.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah.
And I've looked, you know, in the mirror, and I'm not him, so I can't answer that question.
I've seen a few different debates with Hitchens and I've seen kind of, you know, that you know, I've seen that cop out. I don't know. You know what I mean? That's better than making something up, yes. But there's plenty of things we can certainly say that about. And that's exactly what I say about whether I think there are UFOs have ETs in them or not. I don't know. You know, so I guess I'm kind of along the same. I'll take the fifth as well.
Well, you know, some might think it's a cop-out. I just think it's being honest. I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know that the universe is 14 billion years old.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure about the Big Bang. If that's, you know, I think it's very possible that someday, you know, there's so many things that do point to it, but someday they may uncover something. Oh, so this is what happened. I mean, how many times has that happened in science as we went along? You know, you think about the church going back to the church, having Galileo, under house arrest for taking Copernicus's view that the Earth went around the sun. There's a lot of things in religion that have stifled science, real science.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there was more going on there with Galileo than just his view of astrophysics. I think there were some things that he had been saying that the church took issue with in terms of theology. It wasn't just the science.
And would those things be acceptable in today's world, the things that he was saying? I mean, can you give an example?
This is not an area of my study, but I will say this. The Roman Catholic Church sure shows a lot of interest in what might be coming from out there. In fact, they've been talking openly about their willingness to baptize their space brothers and even go so far as to talk theology with them. Because if an advanced civilization comes to Earth from somewhere out there, they may have a more developed theology that might require some recalibration on their part as far as Christian doctrine. I can't go there. Again, I think that the eyewitness testimony of the ministry, life, death, resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, that to me is the anchor point for all of the stuff in the Old Testament that he validated as history. And just my own research into what the neighbors of the ancient Israelites believe, the pagan nations around there, support some things in the Bible that otherwise don't make any sense. But I could do 2 hours just on that topic alone. So rather than go down the rabbit trail, the Roman Catholic Church is a lot more open to things today than they probably were in Galileo's day. Theologically speaking, they're more open now than they were probably 50 years ago in the teachings of, the Jesuit priest, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who was the character. He was the guy on which they based the character Father Lancaster Merrin in The Exorcist. Old guy discovers that, little statue of the demon Pazuzu in Iraq, and then it winds up traveling to Washington, D.C., which explains a lot about our political system, I think. But he believed that the universe and that all of creation was getting more and more sentient. He was credited with coining the term the social network. And that there was the geosphere, the biosphere, and then the noosphere, which is a network of human interaction, human knowledge that was ever growing. And that someday, as we developed and grew in love and knowledge, we would all come together in what he called the omega point and become one with the cosmos and one with the creator. That's very Eastern. That's not Orthodox Christianity. And a lot of his writings were restricted. The distribution of his writings was restricted by the Vatican back in the early 60s. But just recently, a group of Jesuit scientists, because all the Jesuits are, scientists by training, sent a letter to Pope Francis asking him to essentially remove the warning labels from Teilhard's writings. And essentially, when you take what Teilhard taught from a Jesuit perspective and move it into the Silicon Valley, you essentially have the singularitarian movement. And you've got the, instead of the omega point, you've got the singularity of Dr. Raymond Kurzweil. So, there's a lot more overlap between theology and science than most people would like to think. And again, coming back to the UFO phenomenon, a lot of people, and again, I certainly don't want to accuse anyone who's interested in the subject of being in a cult, and certainly not all researchers are looking at the phenomenon for the big answers of life, or answers to the big questions of life, which are, where do we come from? Why are we here? And what happens to us when we die? But there are a lot of people who do. And, God love him. I believe he's sincere, but Dr. Stephen Greer is one of those fellows. Dr. Edgar Mitchell was another.
Right. We may take some calls. Is that okay? If we take a call or two? Okay. Yeah. So the number is up on the screen if you're listening live. Hey, while I have you people live right now, and for listeners that check this out as a podcast at some point and you would like to listen live, I'm actually thinking about moving the date, the day that I do the show, possibly to Saturday, Sunday, or Monday. So, and that's only because sometimes I get busy and Wednesdays are really tough for me to do. So if you would like to put your note in the chat room now, so either Saturday, Sunday, or Monday, I may switch the day to, I may keep it the way it is. But if someone would just reply to that, or if you're listening as a podcast and you would like to contact me because you do listen occasionally live, it's martin@podcastufo.com. martin@podcastufo.com is the email address. So about the Bible, there's a lot of people who have talked like you, there's some connections with UFOs or ETs mm-hmm. in the Bible. But my first question about that is, what makes you, I said this earlier, what makes you believe the Bible is, or what do you think it is, and why do you think it is what you think it is?
Okay. That's a good question. That's something that I began to really look at seriously about 20 years ago. I was found myself as a Mr. Mom of a young daughter, and I realized one night I couldn't explain to her why I thought right was right and wrong was wrong. I didn't know why I believed what I believed. As I said before, I was raised in the church, but could not give an answer for why I thought the Bible would be true. Okay, yeah, this is all nice stuff in here, but what if it's all made up? So I began looking at the textual evidence, the archaeological evidence, and so forth. Books like The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel, other resources like that. When you come right down to it, the texts that have been collated into the New Testament have been preserved more accurately, more carefully over the last 2,000 years than any other text that exists from the classical world. I mean, if one were to say, we can't trust these documents because, then to apply the same standard to the writings of Caesar, the Roman historians, the Greeks, like, you know, Homer, Aristotle, we'd have to throw all of that out because all of their there are fewer copies and they're much newer than the texts that make up the Bible. You look at the and I could go through a number of other reasons, but what cinched it for me was the 15th chapter of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 15, where he says to the church at Corinth, look, this is what was passed on to me. And he goes through, you know, this is what we believe as Christians. And that on the third day he rose again and appeared first to Peter and then to James, his half-brother, and then to the 12, and then to 500 brothers at once, some of whom have fallen asleep, but most are still alive. Essentially, what he was telling the church at Corinth, which is in Turkey today, was that there were a lot of witnesses who saw this guy who had been crucified and yet was alive again. And even though he was writing the letter 20 years later, most of them were still alive. So if you don't believe me, go to Jerusalem and ask around, because there are witnesses still walking around who saw this and can verify what I'm saying to you, what I'm writing to you. And his half brother James, his story, the fact that he was martyred in the year 67 AD. You know, Gospel of John chapter 7 says and his brothers. Go ahead.
Pardon me for just 1 second. We are having an issue with our phone line. I'm using a different computer. I do need to answer this real quickly, and you'll be put on hold for just a second. I'll be right back to you.
Sure.
All right, Derek, here you are.
Okay.
So what happens? I'm in a I guess it didn't come through. The Skype is the phone call. I'm in a hotel room, so I'm using a different computer, and this Skype is not allowing me to add calls. I really apologize for that. So our caller did ask, so I don't know, maybe there was a bunch of silence just now on there. The caller wanted to know what your thoughts were on Father Al Ducci and his thoughts of extraterrestrial life.
I'm not familiar with Father Al Ducci, sadly.
Okay.
Or Father, are you talking about Balducci?
Maybe. I couldn't quite understand what he said. That's probably it. Yes.
Okay. He's one of the researchers with the Vatican Observatory. Well, again, I think that the Vatican is trying to hedge its bets. Again, they've been open to the possibility of extraterrestrial life for a long time. Now, I can't say that I agree with their proposal that they would baptize extraterrestrials should they exist. But again, in that respect, we're getting into an area of theology that's highly speculative. And until we have hard evidence that ETIs actually exist and are visiting us and have some interest in pursuing faith in Jesus Christ, well, it's an interesting exercise. I would rather deal with what we know and the evidence that we have in front of us. It's a topic that my colleague, in fact, my boss, Tom Horn, the CEO of Skywatch TV, has done some research on. He's the author of Exo Vaticana and has actually been down to the Vatican Observatory and talked to some of the folks connected with the research. So we took it in a different direction because we felt Tom and the late Chris Putnam, his co-author, really covered that subject really well.
Now, you've been mentioning Jesus Christ a lot. So you're going back to a couple thousand years. You know, mm-hmm. mankind's been around forever. Why do we think that Jesus Christ existed or is the end all to the way things should be in the one God that you believe in?
Well, it's a fair question. And again, I come back to the eyewitness testimony. We've got the eyewitness testimony of people who saw him, lived with him, worked with him, learned from him. The Gospels, Matthew, John were disciples of his. Mark was a disciple of Peter. Luke was an historian who, in the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, says that he basically talked to people who'd been involved with the movement since the beginning and was very careful to compile an account of what had happened so that others might believe. Luke also wrote the book of Acts and accompanied Paul on some of his travels. And again, as Paul mentioned in his letter to the church of Corinth, you had the 500 witnesses, some of whom he said had died, but most were still around. As I said, in a sense, telling the church at Corinth, if you don't believe the story that I'm telling you, there are still witnesses walking around who saw this guy rise from the dead. So it's the eyewitness testimony. And again, the fact that those texts have been preserved better than any other document from the classical world is the anchor point for me. I would find it really difficult to accept that, yes, this guy walked on water. Yes, this guy performed these miracles and cast out these demons and did this, that, and the other thing, if it had not been for the eyewitness testimony and the fact that the eyewitnesses were then willing to die for that testimony. Yes, people will die for their beliefs, even if those beliefs are wrong. But people who are sane anyway aren't likely to die for something that they know is a lie. So unless all of the apostles were really wrong about what they saw, and because the record shows that all except John were martyred for what they believed. And again, as I started to say, the thing that's interesting for me was James, the half-brother of Jesus, who in John chapter 7 is one of the brothers of Jesus who confronted him and said, hey, aren't you going to go down to the festival in Jerusalem? Because if you want to be known, you can't just keep preaching up here in out in the sticks in Galilee. For even his brothers did not believe in him. And yet, about 35 years later, James was willing to be martyred rather than recant his testimony that Jesus was Messiah. Now, why would he do that? I mean, if my sister had come to me one day and said, hey, before Abraham was, I am. Yeah, right. We'd be calling for medical help. And that's kind of the position that James and his brothers, Jude and others, Simeon, were in. And yet something changed between the time of the crucifixion and the time when James was actually martyred. And it's known from Paul's testimony and others that James was a leader in the early church. What changed? 1 Corinthians 15. The risen Jesus appeared first to Peter, then to James. That might change your worldview, seeing your brother rise from the dead. That's what changed my worldview.
Yeah, I don't know what to... I'm just going to stay agnostic when it comes to things like that. And this kind of the same way I approach the UFO topic, I try to be anyway. You know, there's... Christianity has been around for a couple thousand years. I already mentioned that. Humans have been around for maybe 200,000. It's questionable how long, maybe 300, maybe longer. There's been so many religions where they said, this is it, this is it. There's still religions now around the world that this is the right religion. Why do you think Christianity is the only religion? I mean, do you agree that other people have the rights to practice their own religions?
Oh, sure. See, that's the thing. When God created us all with free will, and that includes the free will to do bad things. In fact, that's the answer, I think, or an answer anyway, for why bad things happen to good people. God did not create us to be automatons, to only do according to his will or only operate within a certain range of actions. You know, I'll let you swing your arm this far, but I'm going to step in and stop you before you hit someone else in the nose. No, he gave us free will to choose. And sadly, a lot of us choose to do bad things. So now I'm not equating doing bad things with choosing to believe in another God. Again, that's part of our creation. God created us all with free will and then sent his son in order to draw men to him. But again, the choice is up to us. So when I talk about this with other people, I try not to be, I get passionate about it, but I try not to be too overbearing about it, because ultimately I can't twist anyone's arm. I can't, you know, take out a gun or use the point of a sword, which sadly has been done by people in the name of Christ in the past. And there's no biblical support for that, let me point out. I'm happy to share the reasons I have faith in Jesus Christ and the reasons for the hope that I have in Christ, which is part of our calling as Christians. But it is not up to me to compel you, and certainly not to try to force you to choose. That is up to you. That is your choice, your decision. So to our Jewish brothers and sisters, Muslim brothers and sisters, Hindus, Buddhists, Jains, Shintos, whatever, you have the right to choose. But I'll be happy to share, you know, if you want, I'll be happy to share the evidence. Now, why do I believe Jesus is the way? Because he said so. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me. That's pretty clear. It would be a lot easier to be a Christian if we could do, like, in fact, I just talked about this today on Skywatch TV. I do a daily news update about 10, 15 minutes in length. A megachurch pastor in Chicago who, and I'm sure you heard the story and all the, you know, the furor from Christians when Joy Behar on The View said that Vice President Pence saying that he gets messages or hears from Jesus is a sign of insanity. Well, a megachurch pastor at a Christian church in Chicago said that the idea that Jesus is the only way to heaven is insanity. And this isn't a fringe guy. This is a guy who is an adjunct professor at the Chicago Theological Seminary. He's also on the he's a dean at the Duke University Divinity School. So this is not a fringe guy. This is a guy who pastors a church of more than 10,000 members saying Jesus isn't the only way. Well, okay, then what I say is that you're not in any real sense a Christian. I'm sorry, not you. You cannot square that with Jesus' own words. I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now, like I said, it'd be a lot easier if we could say he is a way, but that's not what he said.
Do you explain that things happening like the Crusades, where, you know, so many people were killed in the name of Christianity and other, you know, conflicts? Do you push that off as free will of man as well?
Free will, but I mean, free will is a very broad topic. It doesn't mean a good thing, and it's not excusing it, certainly. You know, the fact that somebody chooses to shoot 17 people in a school in Florida, yeah, that's an example of free will, but doesn't excuse what he did. Now, the Crusades are a little more nuanced than people like to think. There were a lot of bad things that happened as the Crusaders got into the Holy Land and started slaughtering people, you know, innocents for no reason. And that is inexcusable. And again, there's no biblical support for doing that. But the Crusades were in large measure a response to the violent expansion of Islam from the 7th century on. So, you know, there's some political, there's some geopolitical stuff in there as well. Killing in the name of Jesus, though, no, that's not in the Bible. That's never, and it's not supported anywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the name of many religions, there has been a lot. I think Christianity certainly has its major share.
Yeah.
So one of the things I noticed, you had some talking points that you sent my way. But before that, there is a question in chat someone wanted me to get to. Actually, was a caller, a second question by him. And he wanted to know what your thoughts on ETs holding religion or dogma so high as humans do. Do you think that's a possibility? First of all, you already said you don't believe there is ETs.
Right.
But if there were, let's hypothetically, if there were ETs.
Well, like politicians, I don't like to answer hypotheticals because they always come back to bite you. But let me say this. One of the things that we hear from contactees, we often hear messages from contactees that have religious themes. And that's one of the things that we explored in the book. In fact, I make the case in the book, and Josh as well. You know, Josh did more of the more recent stuff, looking at the WikiLeaks release of John Podesta's emails between the Apollo astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell and Podesta, who was Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, trying to make contact with Barack Obama. And the reason Mitchell wanted to contact the president was to pass along offers from what he called extraterrestrials from the contiguous universe, you know, a neighboring universe. Again, the extra dimensional hypothesis apparently in view there. And Dr. Mitchell, as the co-founder of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, has a long history in looking for scientific tools to try to understand the supernatural realm. So for him, this was a spiritual quest as well as a scientific quest. And the messages that he was receiving from these entities, and I'm not, and I believe he was hearing from something, I just don't think they were what he thinks they were, had some spiritual and religious overtones. One group that he, in fact, called celestials. Well, celestials is a word that shows up in the New Testament, where some Gnostic believers were criticized by both Peter and Jude in their letters for blaspheming the celestial ones. So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about angelic beings? Possibly. Could it be that Dr. Mitchell was talking about angelic beings? Certainly his colleague, Terry Main, thought so. But are they loyal to God? And if so, which God? My previous book, The Great Inception, I make the case that the gods, small g gods of the Old Testament, such as Molech, Chemosh, Dagon, Asherah, Baal, etc., were real entities, fallen angels, if you will, but gods nonetheless. God in the Bible calls them gods. So we're dealing with a supernatural realm, a spiritual realm that's more heavily populated than most of us Christians have been taught to, which kind of doesn't help us when it comes to trying to understand what Dr. Mitchell was talking about and what other contactees have been talking about. But we hear from other contactees who hear from groups that identify themselves as things like the Ashtar Command or going back to Helena Blavatsky, the Great White Brotherhood, the Masters of Ascended Wisdom, entities, intelligences that live outside the solar system or at least off planet that have come from other worlds. And they very often are bringing messages about how mankind is to evolve and that they're there to offer us their help in so doing. Certainly that's what Dr. Mitchell believed, that they were tools and technologies that they were willing to offer us, such as zero-point energy, if we could show that we would not be violent and take our violent ways out into the universe. So there are often messages from these entities that deal with matters that we can call spiritual, and yet they're often contradictory. even their points of origin are contradictory. They seem to or originate from different places, from contactee to contactee. And one of the things I mentioned in the book is that when you look at the theory itself of ancient astronauts and ancient aliens, you can see that the inspiration for the hypothesis that the gods of the ancient world or the angels of the ancient world were nothing more than visitors from other worlds with far superior technology comes right out of the occult teachings of the 19th century of Helena Blavatsky and Aleister Crowley.
Right. I did see a little bit of that in your book. I was reading that. Here's a interesting question in the chat. Say ETs were proven that they did exist, and you mentioned earlier that you could still keep your faith.
Sure.
The second part of the question, how then would you reconcile the crucifixion and resurrection with that? In other words, do you think that they would happen on other worlds also? In other words, why would we, if ETs are out there and there's like billions of planets with ETs, ETIs as you call them, does each world have its own Jesus and crucifixion and resurrection?
Well, you know, obviously we have no way to know that answer. I mean, the Bible doesn't tell us, and there's no solid evidence one way or the other that exists anywhere else. I mean, that is an interesting thought problem, and it's one that theologians have wrestled with, believe it or not, for, well, centuries. I mean, if there were ETs on another planet, would they have to have their own savior? Would Jesus have to die again and again and again for all of it? Don't know. That's why I tend to believe that if that were the case, God probably would have told us in his word. And that's why I don't personally believe we are ever going to see a true disclosure movement. And I should point out that the website for the book, by the way, where we've got an offer on the book and a variety of other products, over $300 worth of video and book product for just $39, is officialdisclosure.com. So if you go there, it's cheaper than Amazon, officialdisclosure.com. I don't think we're going to see official disclosure because I don't think there's anything officially to disclose. And I approach this a couple of ways. First of all, I don't think we've got hard evidence of actual confirmable extraterrestrial presence on the planet. Secondly, I think that if, and again, I will say that Josh and I do conclude that we have been visited by inhuman entities for literally thousands of years. But again, if we look at from the standpoint of the extra dimensional hypothesis, well, then we're talking about the possibility that these entities are the fallen angels that the Bible tells us about. If the promise of official disclosure right around the corner is of any use to these rebels against the Creator, then I think they're going to get more use out of that promise by keeping that carrot out in front of the horse and never letting the horse catch up to it. It's like when you go see a monster film, they reveal the monster too soon, it loses its impact. You know, if the monster is always just off screen, just, you know, the shadow, the anticipation is kept up far longer into the film. I think the promise of official disclosure is more useful. And again, this is my hypothesis as a Christian, but I think it's more useful to these entities that have been visiting Earth than actually revealing what they've got, because once we saw the actual evidence, I don't think we'd be as impressed as some folks think we would be.
Well, you know, there may be, it may be a letdown to some, but it would really depend on, in my opinion, this is my opinion, I guess, it really depend on what type of communication we had with whatever they are. Right. You know, in other words, do they know something that we don't know about the three questions you mentioned earlier?
Sure.
You know, right. Where do we come from? Where do we go when we die? And why are we here? Whatever. I can't remember. But those questions. yeah, those questions, you know, if they actually knew or had an idea what those what those answers were.
A lot of contactees, sure. And a lot of contactees have said that they have been getting answers like that from these entities. And of course, they never seem to track with the Bible, or I've not at least heard of any that track with the Bible in terms of, you know, the path to salvation. And again, it comes down to that one, you know, sticking point there where Jesus says, you know, he's the only way. You don't get that message from contactees. So that's why I think it's more useful to them to keep dangling the promise of evidence out there without actually disclosing it. There are people, again, who I am sure are hearing from entities. There are people I'm sure who are seeing things. Again, Josh and I make it clear in the book that we don't deny that things are going on. Just based on the evidence, it may not be what people think it is. And I think it comes down to the ability to corroborate some of these things. You know, Dr. Greer, for all of his sincerity, has not produced anything yet that is on the order of, say, a dead man coming back and appearing to, you know, hundreds of people at a single time. You know, somebody that people saw in a very public way expire, give up the ghost, and spend, you know, 3 days in a tomb. So until something like that happens, we're depending on the testimony of, generally speaking, I mean, there are some examples, some exceptions to this. For example, Fatima is one, Medjugorje is another, where, you know, multitudes of people will see, you know, similar things at the same time. But when it comes to specific messages about who these visitors are and what they want to offer to us or what they want from us, we never hear from more than one or two at a time. And often the stories are contradictory. The question I have is, if these entities are truly that advanced, why can't they reach out to more than one person at a time? Why is the contact almost always telepathic, spiritual, in other words? You know, I mean, I'm using a webcam. I'm not certainly a technical genius. Why can't they use a webcam? Send up a flare. You know, use a cell phone.
There was a case several years ago at the Coronado Hotel out in California where there's supposedly was several people that claim that they were all abducted at the same time, you know, and, you know, I have been a lot of times on the fence about, you know, abductions. I just don't know. But I also am open-minded to the fact that it possibly is happening. It just seems to me that it's kind of bizarre that there'd be so many, you know, possibly millions of people coming through. And I think in your book somewhere you mentioned, why would they keep coming back? Maybe that was about something else. That was actually why the UFOs keep coming back. Is that right? Is that right?
Well, I think the question is, you know, why, if these are advanced entities and they're doing something to these contactees, many of whom are clearly traumatized by what they experience, if these are truly advanced entities, you would think that they would be able to detect the fact that they are inflicting trauma upon these contactees and abductees. Certainly, when we abduct a lower life form for, you know, experimentation in a laboratory, okay, we can tell when we're inflicting trauma on a guinea pig or on a monkey. We can tell. That's why there are animal rights activists who get very upset about experimenting on animals. If these entities are as advanced as we would like to think they are, and clearly must be in order to, you know, if they did in fact cross the vast gulf of space to get here, why do they keep hurting people? Why do the people who've been through this experience find themselves, well, as Dr. John Mack pointed out in his study, with so many points of correlation, something like more than two dozen, I think three dozen points of correlation between the accounts of abductees and the accounts of people who have been ritually abused. At some point, you would think that they would say, hey, okay, we're hurting these things. And maybe they don't consider us sentient. Maybe they don't care. I don't know. But that, again, that speaks to their nature and perhaps to their intent. And again, one of the things I found really influential meeting Jack, but didn't talk to him very long at the Roswell conference, but I did read his book and listen to a number of interviews that he's given. The Jack Brewer book, The Grays Have Been Framed, is a really serious and hard look at the way abductees are treated in the UFO community. And it really changed my view, shifted my view on the abduction phenomena. I believe it's real. Again, I just don't think it is what most in the community think it is.
So if so you actually think that the disclosure, going back to that, you actually think that is being controlled by whatever the entities are that are showing up here? Is that, did I catch that right?
Well, to a degree. I mean, again, that's, I'm just trying to figure out a hypothesis here. I think the belief that the government controls all this information and is just not wanting to let it out, I think that may be giving the government a little too much credit for what it actually knows or what it thinks it knows. I think that this deception, and I'll use that word purposely, this deception that we're being visited by extraterrestrial entities, because again, I don't think they're extraterrestrial. Extra-dimensional, yeah, I can buy that, is useful if we hypothesize extra-dimensional entities that have a specific agenda in mind. And if these extra-dimensional entities are what we as Christians would call fallen angels, well, what would their agenda be? It's to get people to believe anything but that one thing that I talked about earlier, which is, you know, faith in Jesus Christ. So they don't really care if you believe in Allah or in Zeta Reticulans or whatever, or, you know, as long as it's not the one thing, they're good. And I think as you look at the history of the UFO phenomenon and how the craft, the types of craft that witnesses have seen have changed over years, to where it seems to match the culture, so that people seeing an unidentified flying ship would relate it to something that they were familiar with, like the Texas UFO flap from the 1890s. They were seeing airships, flying airships. Alexander the Great in the 4th century BC saw flying shield. The modern flying saucer phenomenon, when you look at the sketch that Kenneth Arnold drew, and Kenneth Arnold's sighting was really the first major sighting of the post-war era. He didn't actually describe them as looking like saucers. They looked a little more like flying wings, which was a type of aircraft that the United States and Germany were experimenting with in the 40s. In fact, it's the shape of some of our more modern aircraft that are flying today, you know, stealth aircraft and stealth bomber. But he said that they moved like, and I'm sure you know this, Martin, it moved like saucers being skipped across the water, and hence we get flying saucers, and suddenly everybody's right. Seeing these round saucer-shaped things. So I think the enemy, and I'll use that word as, you know, capital E enemy, these fallen angels, and again, this is my hypothesis with the evidence that we have available to us. If they are, in fact, responsible for these extra-dimensional incursions into our realm, choose whatever shape or form would prove most useful to their storyline, to promoting their narrative, which is that we're being visited by extraterrestrial intelligences who were, in fact, our creators, and now they're back to help us evolve to the next level of our development.
Just to let you know, the Alexander the Great, you know, flying shield thing, can only be traced back to 1959 when some author wrote it in a book. So that has been kind of deconstructed.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
There's also Maury Island. The last time I was talking that, I had all these people tell me that has been totally debunked. I don't really know. I've never seen the debunking of Maury Island, but I would be interested if someone could email me that information, where that information lies. I just don't know.
Well, I think it's really curious that Fred Crisman, who was one of the principal witnesses to the Maury Island incident, is a guy who shows up in connection with a number of other famous conspiracies in the U.S. here over the last 70 years. He was a friend of the father of Michael Riconosciuto, who was connected to the Promise software theft and the whole Octopus investigation. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
Okay. Michael Riconosciuto is an interesting fellow. I think he's been in prison, may just have been released within the last 6 months or so. But yeah, that's a whole story. 1984, 85, a company called Inslaw developed a program called Promise, PROMIS, which was case management software for, anyway, Riconosciuto figured out how to swipe it on behalf of some other folks. Anyway, Fred Crispin shows up there. Jim Garrison in the JFK investigation in New Orleans thought that Crispin was one of the tramps in the rail yard, I think. And there's another bit of another quote from a book that I included in The Day the Earth Stands Still about Crispin, who was apparently the source for information that was turned into a UFO television series in the 1960s. So Crispin is one of those intelligence community guys who keeps showing up at a number of these stories. And he was right there at Moray Island.
Isn't that something? Wow. Hey, one thing I wanted to tell you is we have the images that you sent us over that we can load up as we're talking. So if you think the topic that you are speaking of represents that image, could you please tell us so the show producer can pop that up? Unfortunately, okay. I never got a chance to look at the images, so I don't know what's there. Fallen angels, you mentioned that a couple of times in the Bible. So are there other possible things that people can connect to the Bible when it comes to, well, we want to say extraterrestrial or, you know, being visited? Is there any other parallels that you can think of when it comes to the Bible?
Well, one of the things we thought was really strange when we started digging into the research here, several years ago, I had the opportunity to interview Peter Lavenda, who has researched the occult quite a bit, but he's also done a lot of research into the space program and the odd connections between, you know, Nazis, UFOs, and NASA. He wrote a book called The Dark Lord, in which he traced those strange connections between the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft, who was the creator of the Cthulhu mythos back in the 20s and 30s, and Aleister Crowley, who was the occultist who founded Thelema, probably the best-known occultist of the 20th century. Lavenda showed that when he wrote the Cthulhu mythos in 1926, and he said there's no evidence that Lovecraft knew of Crowley's work. He might have known or heard Crowley's name, but he didn't know of Crowley's work. And Lovecraft was an atheist, professing atheist. But he was happy as a horror author to draw on the teachings of occultists like Blavatsky. And he mentions theosophy a number of times in his stories and used that as grist for his mill. Well, in 1926, when he wrote The Call of Cthulhu, which is the story that he's best known for and his best known monster, if you will, Cthulhu was the dead but sleeping, dead but dreaming god who lies in this ruined city at the bottom of the ocean. So already you've got a number of things there that come out of theosophy, you know, the lost continents, megalithic architecture and stuff like that, created by a superior ancient race that might return someday when the stars align correctly. Lavenda pointed out that in the story, Lovecraft set the action back in 1907, and on Halloween night of 1907 in particular, when in the story, the police in New Orleans find the statue of this little, you know, this little statue of Cthulhu, who was the, you know, the star of the story. Well, it just so happens that on Halloween night in 1907, Aleister Crowley was channeling something, channeling an entity that was feeding him the teachings that became some of the books of the law for his religion, Thelema. And in the course of writing on Halloween night, one of the things that he wrote down in this channeling session was the name Cthulhu. Sounds kind of like Cthulhu, not exactly, but kind of like it. But Lavenda pointed out that Crowley's personal secretary and successor, Kenneth Grant, who took Crowley's teachings and developed it into what he called the Typhonian order, or the Typhonian OTO, believed that Crowley just misheard the word, and that what he should have heard was Cthulhu, or Cthulhu. In other words, Grant, and thus Lavenda in his research, concluded that Crowley and Lovecraft were channeling the same source, even though Lovecraft believed he was an atheist. They believed that he was hearing from the same spirit entity that was feeding information to Aleister Crowley. Well, Kenneth Grant took Crowley's teachings, as I said. Crowley believed he was welcoming in what he called the Aeon of Horus. Horus was one of the Egyptian gods. Grant developed his teachings and believed that what he was bringing in or inaugurating was the Aeon of Set. Well, Set is the chaos god of Egypt. The god, the Greeks called Typhon, hence the Typhonian order. So, it believed that what he was hearing, or what he had learned from the teachings of Crowley, was what he called the Sirius Set current, or the Set Sirius current. In other words, something coming from the star system Sirius, from this entity, this chaos god, who was coming back to Earth someday, just as Lovecraft wrote that these old gods would someday return when the stars were right and reclaim dominion over the Earth. And apparently Grant was very disturbed about that, and why he spent so much time researching and trying to develop this form of chaos magic. Well, I don't know if your viewers, listeners are familiar with chaos magic. It's certainly not something I'm very well educated on, but apparently this is a bigger deal than I realized when we got into researching the book here. It wasn't quite the direction we expected things to go. But looking at this belief that, let me finish a point here and come back to then why this is important. The reason this is important was when you tie this together with the research of a gentleman named Jason Colavito, who is generally speaking a skeptic when it comes to the supernatural. He shows that the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft was very influential on the modern ancient aliens movement, because after Lovecraft's death in 1936, a number of friends of Lovecraft kept writing in the same genre, using some of the creations and creatures that Lovecraft invented. And Lovecraft's work was republished. It was sent out to soldiers during World War II to entertain them while they were out in the trenches. The French, it turns out, in the 1950s, discovered H.P. Lovecraft and loved Lovecraft. His stuff was translated into French and republished in a number of magazines there. And a couple of science fiction magazine publishers named Powell's and Bergier, drawing on the work of Lovecraft and the themes that he incorporated, you know, cyclopean architecture, megalithic structures that nobody can explain how they came to be, old gods and the return of, the return of these old gods, wrote a book called Morning of the Magicians, published in about 1960, which, again, explored a lot of these themes that we see in ancient aliens today. Well, it was translated into English about 63, sold pretty well. And like anything, when you create something new in literature or movies or music that sells well, people pick up on it and try to replicate it, copy it, and sell their own. Well, one author who picked up on Powell's and Bergier's work, inspired by Lovecraft, which Crowley's successor believed was just channeled Aleister Crowley, was a hotel operator in Switzerland by the name of Eric von Daniken. And von Daniken published Chariots of the Gods in 1970. Powell's and Bergier were not pleased because they felt that his work was a little too close to theirs for coincidence. But be that as it may, Chariots of the Gods has become the best-selling archaeology book in history. And von Daniken has gone on to sell something like 60 million copies of books around the world. A couple of years after Chariots of the Gods, Zechariah Sitchin came along and published The Twelfth Planet, which made the case that the Sumerian gods, the Anunnaki, were actually aliens who came to Earth and created humanity as a slave race. Again, this tracks with some of the themes of Helena Blavatsky and Theosophy from the 1880s. So again, you've got Blavatsky, Crowley, filtered through Lovecraft, repackaged by von Daniken and Sitchin, and now Ancient Aliens is in its 12th season on the History Channel. it is essentially warmed over occult teachings. In fact, that's why there are some critics like Colavito who say Ancient Aliens is nothing more than televangelism for theosophy. So it's got religious overtones that I don't think people who are intrigued by the idea are even aware of.
I know Zachariah Sitchin. I heard he was a very, very nice man, but he had some really far out things to say. And we've had Eric von Daniken on a couple of times. Interesting man. I know he's had kind of a little bit of a checkered past. A number of people have sent me links and things. Still a nice man, you know. Seems to be a very fun person to talk to. I always enjoy mm-hmm. talking to him.
Well, I'd enjoy having a conversation with him. I doubt that I would agree with him very much, but I certainly don't want to be unkind to either yeah. him or to the late Mr. Sitchin, who, yes, by all accounts, was very nice. But I've been reading a lot of Sumerian cosmology over the last couple of years. I'm not a scholar in it. I'm certainly not an expert in it, but I have yet to see anything in any credentialed academic paper about what the Sumerians believed about their gods that leads me to conclude that there was any hint that those things were anything or thought to be anything other than supernatural beings. And our friend Dr. Michael Heiser, whose name I mentioned earlier, who can read the Sumerian, has said that, you know, Mr. Sitchin just either didn't know what he was translating or because the words just don't say what he claimed that they said.
Right. Now, in your book, you talk about MUFON, and this is where you and I agree. and that is the fact that the 2017, event
International
that they had,
Symposium. Yeah,
had some way, way out fringy topics. And I think that was a big mistake myself. I understand there's an entertainment value, but it just muddies the water of people that are trying to figure this thing out.
Right.
Not only that, let's talk about there's the MUFON inner circle.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit about that.
And actually, I think that's changed because I went to try to find the website here today and could not find the listing of the inner circle. So maybe the website's been updated. Maybe the circle's been changed. But I know this came out just about the time we went to Roswell last year, where there was a controversy about a couple of things. And one of them I don't want to even get into because I don't know enough of the backstory. It's about some personal beliefs of one of the other members of the inner circle that had to do with an issue I don't want to – a can of worms I don't want to open. But
you're talking about the racist remarks.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know enough about that to say to make any comments on that. But in the case of Jay-Z Knight and the inner circle at MUFON, at least. That's one of the images I put in that.
It's up now right now.
OK. And I circled Jay-Z Knight because she is or was, at least at the time I took that, which was last July or August, a member of the inner circle, which is sort of an advisory council for MUFON, which bills itself as the world's leading organization for the scientific investigation of unidentified flying objects. Well, there's no nice way to put this, but Jay-Z Knight is a cult leader, and she claims to channel a 36,000-year-old warrior from the lost continent of Lemuria. Now, again, Lemuria goes right back to Helena Blavatsky. That was part of her teachings, the origin of humanity. The root races came from this continent of Lemuria, where the noble warriors of Lemuria had to do battle with the evil wizards and sorcerers of Atlantis. Again, there's been no hard evidence that either of those continents exist. In fact, Lemuria was only hypothesized 1866. A paleontologist who noticed that there were similar monkey fossils in India and in Madagascar. Now, if you look at a globe, you'll see that there's an awful lot of ocean between India and Madagascar. So he was trying to figure out how you could get lemur fossils, small monkeys, that are almost identical in those two places. So hence, there must have been a lost continent somewhere in the Indian Ocean, thus Lemuria. that became part of Blavatsky's religion. That's who Jay-Z Knight channels as her source of spiritual wisdom, Ramtha the Enlightened One. And somehow she was able to pay the fee to become a member of the inner circle of MUFON.
Now, I can see why Sirius, $5,000 donation.
Yeah, and I can see how serious researchers into UFOs would be a little upset at that.
I don't think it's a good idea at all. Anytime anything like that happens, then you're putting some type of control in the hands of someone that doesn't necessarily deserve it. And I listened to Kevin Randall was doing a show for a short time.
And this is one of the articles that I read about that.
He interviewed
source information. Yeah.
Yes, he interviewed Jan Harzen, and he basically asked him flat out, "Why are you doing that?" You know, I mean, it's really, you know, he called him on it, and I think it's I'm not a MUFON member right now. I don't have things against them, but I do think that they have taken a few wrong turns. Jan Harzen's trying to do a really good job. He's got a lot of pressure on his plate to bring membership up. Membership is not, it's only like 3,500 or something like that. It's not a really big membership. So, but when these people are donating $5,000 to get into the inner circle, I just think that's I think that's taboo for any organization myself.
Well, yeah, I think that opens a can of worms. It's a dangerous practice. And as you mentioned, there was some other controversy about that as well. But especially when you've got somebody who's approaching the topic this way, from her perspective, that really is a cloud. You know, as in the organization I belong to, we certainly wouldn't want somebody on the board of directors who brings a worldview that would call our work, that would be contrary to what we believe, but would call our organization into question in any way. So again, you know, one of our friends, good friend, Joe Jordan, is still a director with MUFON. He came out of the state of Florida. He's now the national director for South Korea. But like me, like Josh, he is a professing Christian, openly Christian. And what led him to his Christian faith was his research, his investigations into the abduction phenomena, and found that, to his surprise, there were a number of cases that other researchers had basically not publicized or not told anyone about because they didn't know what to make of the information, which was that the abductions could be stopped by people calling on the name of Jesus. You know, if these were entities from another world, one wonders why that would have any effect whatsoever. But if it was a spiritual phenomenon, and in the Bible we see that the demons that Jesus encountered were always subject to people giving them commands in his name, that is an interesting bit of evidence. And as he began to research, he found more and more of these cases. And Joe, like Josh, admits that at the time he began his investigations, he was a new ager. He said, you know, carrying the crystals and, you know, doing all, you know, the meditating and stuff as like a good new ager. And those are basically how Joe describes it, not how I would describe it. But he says the evidence just led him in a different direction. And so, you know, that's really what Josh and I are saying. Let's just follow the evidence where it leads. And again, it may be that I'm wrong. Maybe extraterrestrials do exist and that God decided it wasn't important for us to know and put it in the Bible. I don't think that's the case, but, you know, hey, I could be wrong about that. But what I do know is that what the Bible tells me is that me, you, everyone watching this, assuming they're human, created in God's image. Created in God's image, and that status will not change regardless of what happens in the future.
Interesting. I like talking to people like you because one of the reasons I do this show is that I just like to hear people's opinions of what they think is going on. And this is certainly one that I have not heard before.
I'm glad to hear that because we were hoping that would be the case.
There was a talking point you had here about what WikiLeaks revealed about the role of the Pope in the previous U.S. presidents. I didn't know there was something in those leaked emails that had directly to do with that.
Is this something you found?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is actually, that's a section of the book that Josh really dug into. So I would prefer it if Josh, you know, if MediaCom hadn't shut that, if Russia hadn't shut up Josh tonight, that's probably what they were trying to stop, because he's better educated on that. There was another point that it just occurred to me I never got back to when I was talking about the whole Cthulhu von Daniken thing. And this gets back to the chaos magic aspect of it, if you don't mind if I just elucidate
that
just a little bit, because this comes back to the Bible. In Genesis 1, verse 2, there is a verse there, and let me bring it up here electronically, because it deals with an entity that this Kenneth Grant, who is Aleister Crowley's successor, named as the God that he believed was reaching out to try to contact him, this Typhon or Set, this God of chaos, who he believed we needed to get right with because he was coming back someday. And actually, this is an entity that's mentioned in the Bible, but it's just another one that we never hear about in church, because you start digging into theology, you start digging into the original Hebrew text, and it gets a little complex. But, you know, I would suggest when you're dealing with matters of eternal consequence, you know, like heaven and hell, maybe it's worth our time to study it. Anyway, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. Now, the word translated deep there is a Hebrew word, tahom. That word tahom is a cognate that means same word, different language, with an Akkadian word, temtum. That word temtum was the name of the chaos dragon of Sumerian mythology called Tiamat. And this chaos dragon or the chaos serpent shows up in a number of ancient Near Eastern religions. In the Bible, it's called Leviathan. The Canaanites had a name for it. They called it Lotan. You had Set and Typhon. Typhon was the Greek version of this chaos monster. But the theme was the same in all of these ancient religions, that a warrior god, in the Bible, it's Yahweh. The Sumerians, it was first Enlil, and then later it was Marduk when the Babylonians took over. In Canaanite mythology, it was Baal. And then Zeus, in the Greek myth, had to defeat the chaos monster Typhon in order to establish order out of chaos, if you will. But this theme was that chaos was represented by the ocean, and especially sea monster. You see it mentioned a few times in the Bible. There are times when the ocean is clearly used as a symbol for chaos or disorder. But we see that even though this chaos entity is defeated by the second verse of the Bible, it's not dead. I mean, it's supernatural. It's not dead yet. But there's an interesting reference right at the end of the Bible in the second to last chapter, Revelation chapter 21. And of course, now our internet's getting slow. The Apostle John in Revelation 21 writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." This is a prophecy of something in the future. A new heaven and a new earth, because the first one passed away. But then he adds, "And the sea was no more." The sea was no more. Well, obviously, the first heaven and first earth passed away. The sea would have passed away with the first earth, right? But John mentions it separately, because again, in the Bible, and in the ancient Near East, for thousands of years, the sea represented chaos. It was this chaos entity. In fact, in the Canaanite myth, their chief god, Baal, who was the storm god, had to fight against the god of the sea called Yam and defeat it in order to claim his kingship over the gods. The Bible reflects this. Genesis 1, verse 2. Spirit of God hovering over the face of the deep, almost as though it was containing it and keeping it restrained. But it isn't until Revelation 21, new heaven, new earth, and the sea, chaos, was no more. Kenneth Grant believes that this chaos monster, Set, or Typhon, is what's coming back, and he developed his whole magical system about it. Do a search on the web, if you're feeling brave, for chaos magic. You'll see a lot of information out there about how to practice it and what it's good for today. I don't recommend dabbling in it, obviously, as a Christian. I'm just telling you that it's out there. It's a thing. But the thing that I find really curious about this is that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is the search for signals coming from outer space, the acronym SETI is the Egyptian word that means man of Set, man of the chaos god. And Richard Greer's organization, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, CSETI, likewise, man of Set. Probably a coincidence, probably fine.
Oh, I don't know. So the Bible, you know, you were talking about translation. You know, it was, I guess, from Hebrew to Greek sometime around the 3rd century BC. And then the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. But the translation of the Bible, then there's King James Bible. And then there's the, I don't know what you would call it, the when they changed everything to Yao, thou shalt, and all that stuff. You know, there's been many translations is what I'm getting at. Right. How do we know how, first of all, you know, this is, of course, a show about UFOs, but it's still interesting to me to ask, you know, this question. How do we know what you're reading today in the Bible? Is anything like, it's kind of like the game Telephone. What did it start out as? And
That's a really excellent question. And it gets back to what I said earlier, that there are more old copies of texts for the Bible than there is for anything else out of the ancient world. The oldest complete copy of the book probably goes back to about 326. And you think, okay, well, that's 300 years after Jesus died. That's not very new. Well, yeah, okay. But the oldest copy that we have, the oldest copy of anything that we've got from, say, Julius Caesar, who lived about 50 years before Jesus of Nazareth, dates about 1,000 BC or 1,000 AD, rather. So you've got 1,000 years, but nobody questions that Julius Caesar actually wrote his history of how he defeated the, you know, the Celtic tribes in Gaul. There are other examples like that, but the thing that really got it for me is this: when you look at the letters of the early church fathers, and we're talking now before the Council of Nicaea, because I know there are a lot of people who think, oh yeah, Constantine the Great basically took the books that he wanted and threw everything else out at the Council of Nicaea. Well, that's actually not true. But setting that aside, when you take the letters of the early church fathers from the early second through early 3rd century, so about from 100 AD to the early 200s, the letters that they wrote back and forth, they quoted so much scripture, New Testament scripture, that you could reconstruct the entire New Testament from their writings, except for about 15 verses, and none of those 15 verses have anything to do with doctrine. In other words, Jesus died in the ground 3 days, rose again from the dead, died for our sins. None of that was in those 15 missing verses. So you can use their letters as a cross-check on what we got later to see if stuff has changed. And scholars who've done this have found that the Bible is over 98%, the New Testament, over 98% unchanged. And none of those most of those 2% changes are like, you know, grammatical things or you know, missing diacritical marks or, you know, apostrophes and commas and things. So again, they can really, we really can know that the texts that we have been accurately preserved for the last 2,000 years.
Interesting. Yeah. But how, you know, getting back to the languages, you know, I know that that's always tough to translate one language to another, you know what I mean? But we get the gist of it is in the stories, which I think are kind of, some of them are pretty far out there. And then, you know, for God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son, right. That is one thing I don't get. I don't think there would be a God like that. I don't get that.
Well, that's interesting you mentioned that, because that's actually an area of study. Now that you mentioned that, I'm going to have to include that in the forthcoming book. In the culture from which Abraham emerged, that was actually not uncommon. That was not uncommon. Now, again, we have to assume that there were other small g gods, fallen angels, if you prefer, who were whispering things in other ears. But when you look at the religion of the ancient world, the Amorites in particular, who were a people known to scholars for, you know, last couple hundred years. But in the days of Abraham, they controlled the entire ancient Near East. Everything on a map today, that's Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, even northern Egypt. I mean, when the Israelites were in Egypt, they weren't Egyptians ruling northern Egypt. They were Amorites. They were Semitic-speaking people like the Hebrews. And they were really into venerating dead ancestors and sacrificing children, if need be, in order to ensure the favor of their gods. In fact, in May, my wife and I and a group of about 100 people are touring Israel, Jordan, and then going to Rome and Sardinia with a smaller group. And one of the things we'll be looking at are the Tophets of the Phoenicians, who were the descendants of the Amorites, where they sacrificed their children to their gods. So this was not an unknown thing. But when God said, okay, do this, okay, testing Abraham's faith, but then he stopped him and said, okay, stop. This is not who I am. Look over here. There's a ram caught in the thicket. Sacrifice that instead. But yeah, child sacrifice, adult sacrifice, not an uncommon thing in the ancient world.
Yeah, not good either. So your next book is, we talked a little bit just before the start of the show, is kind of going, this trip that you're going to be making sounds absolutely fantastic. Is that in part of research for this book you have? And go ahead and announce what that's going to be.
Well, we'll be in Israel from May 6th through the 16th and then heading from there to Jordan for a few days. We'll get to see Mount Nebo, where Moses looked across the Jordan River to see the Promised Land. We'll also get to see some of those dolmens, which are like miniature stone hinges.
Yes. Yeah. I saw them in Russia. They're really interesting. They don't even know how old they are because they're made of stone. They could be 25,000 years old. They have no idea.
Exactly. Most scholars in the ancient Near East along the Jordan River valley, they put it at 3,000 years or so, which is just before Abraham came along, 4,000 years or so. But still, we'll get a chance to see those. And that is significant. I don't want to take too much time here, but it ties in with the prophecy of Gog and Magog. There's a curious reference to something called the Valley of the Travelers in the prophecy of that war that relates to the dolmens. But then we'll be going on the 19th of May to Rome and then to Sardinia. So we'll get to tour the Vatican. We'll also see the historical sites of Rome and then in Sardinia, where there are a number of Tophets, which are ritual sites where children were sacrificed and buried to their god Baal Hamon, who scholars equate with the Greek god Kronos, or Saturn of the Romans, El of the Canaanites. Kronos, of course, was the god who Zeus and the Olympians, leader of the Titans, who Zeus and the Olympians overthrew and then sent down to Tartarus. There's actually a mention in the Bible of angels who sinned and were punished by being sent to Tartarus.
Wow. I don't know how we could have ever had the mindset that it's okay to sacrifice our children. That's just horrible. But
well, God says it's something that never entered his mind. So that's part of the point. These are rebel gods who convinced the people around ancient Israel to do it. And I mean, if we look to here in our continent, it was a sacrifice. It was a practice that was taking place here in the Americas.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that have taken place. I know even slavery among Native Americans, even, you know, among themselves. So a lot of things that we don't know about or ever talked about in history learned in school anyway. Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure. And again, hold your book up for the people on YouTube one more time. Can you hear me okay? Well, I think we just lost him. Did we just lose you? All right. Nope. He's gone. Oh, there you are. Okay. Yeah, hold your book up one more time.
Oh, appreciate that. Yeah. And again, the website is officialdisclosure.com. That's officialdisclosure.com.
Officialdisclosure.com. Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure. All right. Let's see. All right. You can, if you could, I'm having trouble with this Skype. I'm going to have to ask you to hang up if you would. Thank you very much. All right. All right, everyone.
Appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, I did too. Thank you. All right, everyone. So that's it for the show. Thanks so much for checking us out and listening. If you support the show, thanks so much. If you'd like to do that and you haven't, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com and it's right there. So we'll be back next week with Greg Bishop. I'm really excited about that. He's got a wonderful podcast called Radio Misterioso. And so he'll be on next week. He'll be live streaming with us here as usual. And I want to thank some people that help out with the show. First of all, Evan, the show producer, thank you. We had a challenge tonight and you pulled through. I also want to thank Peggy for managing the Facebook page. You can like us on Facebook. I think we have a lot of people there. And there's postings every day on that site. We also have a guest blog. You can check that out at podcastufo.com. And that's about To the Stars, an opinion about that. So that's it. And I hope I didn't leave anyone out for, yeah, of course, I want to thank our guest, Derek Gilbert, that was on the show tonight. I don't want to forget that. And so that's it. And thank you all. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.